Lord Most High, thank you for this night. Thank you for keeping us safe. Look down upon those for whom life is a struggle this evening. Some for whom it's a struggle all the time, but some especially this evening in the midst of the storm. Pray that you would prosper us this time and that your light would shine in our hearts, our minds, and in all that we think and say and do. Guide our discussion in Christ's name. Amen. Well, thank you for braving it out here. I think, actually, if I know about the Pharisees' poor curry, my wife knows just as much because I've shared pretty much everything with her, whether she has remembered any of it or is trying desperately to forget it. I don't know. Let me just add one thing to what Quinn has said. You may or may not know, this is a little tooting of my own horn, that my dissertation is published. It's published, actually, by a Jewish publishing group, a Brown University series in Judaic Studies. I mention this because I was stupid enough to include Greek in this. And this was published just before the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Biblical Literature began holding seminars on how to write your dissertation in such a way that you could publish it for money afterwards. So I signed something which says, I get no money whatsoever. I mean, zilch for this. But actually, a part of what you're seeing is a movement in the academic world, and it's not all bad, to make accessible to the general public studies which are generally fairly esoteric, or they are crowded with footnotes, pluses and minuses on that, or they have foreign languages in them which people look at and say, this is not for me. So let me give a little background and tell you what we need to be doing at 7:25. We said we'd be out of here at 8:30, so maybe we'll run 10 minutes over. I hope that I will be through my part in about 40 minutes or so, and maybe I can have Holly or somebody else, or maybe all of you. You just kind of wave at me when you've had enough, and it's time for questions. But I certainly do want us to have time for questions. I do want to give a little background and actually to pick up on Quinn's statement about the book and our interest in it, and really begin with this question, why all the hype, why all the interest? In fact, the book was climbing up the bestseller list pretty rapidly, even before the famous or infamous Fox interview, and there is in your sheet, if you want to go to that interview, you can actually Google it and get there, but I do have the website where you can see it, where Reza Aslan was interviewed, and as Quinn said, the interview went viral, and you can see it on YouTube just now. So why the interest? Well, in part because this is a national pastime, in a sense far more than many other countries. I think far more than in my home country of Great Britain, discussions on religion, national discussions on religion and on Christianity are a part of our fabric, the way of life that we have here. And so when things come up, as they do from time to time, it's big news. So we have television documentaries. You go back in time, it's 1988, but there are others since then. There was a big PBS documentary called From Jesus to Christ, The First Christians. And I don't know if you saw that. It still comes on the television from time to time, and many of these are repeated from time to time. Movies, you go way back. You've got the Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, The Robe, and all of those kinds of things way back. But then you've got, remember, all the hype for The Last Temptation of Christ and Martin Scorsese. When I was living in San Antonio, I snuck into a movie theater where none of my congregation would see me just to see what it was all about. But people were talking about this. Is this undermining our faith? What's happening to that? And then, in a sense, on the other side, you have the Passion of Christ and the suffering of Jesus back in 2004, causing quite a stir as well because of the brutal violence in the film and for other reasons as well. If you look at our major news magazines, you will find most Easters and Christmases, there's going to be an article on the front page about something happening or discovery with regard to the Christian faith. There are books on these subjects. This is by no means the first book on the subject. Some of you are familiar with the writing of John Shelby Spong, Episcopal bishop. One of his books is Why Christianity Must Change or Die, or Elaine Pagels, professor at Princeton University, writing on the Gnostic Gospels, Gospels which at the earliest are the 2nd century, some maybe 3rd century, accounts outside the Bible. And many of these accounts have a kind of a conspiracy theory idea attached to them. Why were these thrown out, kicked out, left out, ignored, rejected, and so forth? That conspiracy theory way of approaching things is integral to Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code. So that, too, created quite a stir with regard to these things. On another front, there have been archaeological discoveries, and we genuinely say, what difference does this make? Does this undermine? Does this affirm? And often you hear things, now this confirms every word in the Bible, or wait, we can't trust this anymore. The biggest discoveries down at the Dead Sea community in the 1940s, early 1950s, the Dead Sea Scrolls from the Qumran community. And then in Egypt, a place called Nag Hammadi, the Gnostic Gospels that Elaine Pagels speaks about and others come from a discovery there. And the stories of these discoveries are really fascinating. And then more recently, and there are dozens that we could refer to, some of you may remember hearing about the James Ossuary. Any of you heard about the James Ossuary? An ossuary, the bones of somebody who's died, and it has James on it. I think the word Jesus is on there, or Joseph is on there, and people put two and two together and say, wait a minute, how many families have all these same names in there? Maybe this is Jesus' family or James, the brother of Jesus, and if it is, so. If it isn't, so. But the debate goes on, and actually that debate, even though it began in 2002, is still going on as to whether this could be genuine or whether it's not. And these are genuinely fascinating. And then you've got the bigger religious questions of the day, which concern all of us. Religious pluralism is, I think, the biggest question of the day. Are all religions the same? Are we just, as Christians, do we have our own metaphor for religious truth or metaphors? And is everybody else's religious truth pretty much the same as our religious truth, except they clothe it in a different garment? A recent book on that is worth reading. It's by Stephen Prothero at Boston University, who is not a Christian, but who wants to say, no, they are not all the same. They have different goals. They have different purposes. And while he is sympathetic, he does not write from the point of view of being a Christian saying, none of them are like us. We are better than they are. But nevertheless, the question is real. Then the question about in our modern day and age, can we believe what we once believed? Are we modern people? How are we modern people in our day and age? Are all the problems in the world, here's another one, caused by people who believe things really strongly? If you hold on to something really strongly, that's going to lead to antagonism, and it may lead to war, and Christians and Muslims are blamed for that. Hindus tend to be deemed to be a little more flexible because Hindus can embrace other gods, yet there are times in which Hindus can be pretty fierce as well. But that's a question which is out there. A book I recommend for you is by the former professor of divinity at Oxford, Keith Ward, a book called Is Religion Dangerous? A really interesting book on that subject, in which he says, no, not in and of itself. Of course, there are religions that can be dangerous, but there's nothing inherent in them or believing seriously which necessitates that. And then the whole business of, are we right and are they wrong? Who's right and who's wrong? Is anybody right? Is anybody wrong? And so these questions are all around about us, and you may be asking these questions, and if you are not, then your children almost certainly are. So some of the big questions are the background of this, some of the natural interest in our nation as a part of this, and some of it has to do with the human interest about the author and the Fox News interview, which once again, if you haven't seen it, I've got the link right here. You might want to look at and see, raise this issue. So what's the story? This is a story which is there at the beginning of the book, right? At the beginning of the book, Reza Aslan describes who he is. He's an Iranian, an immigrant, grew up in a Muslim household, but it was nominal. They were really pretty secular. Became an evangelical Christian through young life. Quinn, you became a Christian through young life, right? Do you have a book that you're about to write? So he became an evangelical Christian, believed strongly, and then left it behind. He said he no longer could trust the Bible. And this places him in a particular camp. There are some others out there, and perhaps there are many others out there, but the most famous is Dr. Bart Ehrman at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who is very popular because of the Learning Company tapes many people look at, who said, who went to Princeton Seminary and decided that he could no longer trust the Bible, though he has become a professor of religion, is an expert in the New Testament text in Greek, but said he no longer believes it. His wife does, he says, but he doesn't. And Elaine Pagels, to a certain extent, is in this camp as well. Whatever faith she had in the past is not the same as what she has now. It's quite different. So there are others in this camp as well. So it's, I did believe, now I don't believe, but I did come from a Muslim background, now I'm a Muslim again. This is all very interesting, and that was part of the conversation on the Fox News interview. Confusing conversation, but it's related to, can a Muslim write about Christian faith objectively? Well, can Christians write about Christian faith objectively? Can anybody write about anything objectively? Is a good question to ask, but that was the approach of the interview. And of course, there are Christians who write about Jewish faith and about Muslim faith. There are Jews who write about Christian. I mean, this is going on all the time, but that's still part of the hype that's here. Interestingly, Reza Aslan's mother and wife are still practicing Christians. And then he has what may appear to be a rather strange statement. He says in the introduction, 2 decades of academic research into the origins of Christianity has made me a more committed disciple of Jesus of Nazareth than I ever was of Jesus Christ. So isn't that an intriguing statement to hear and a way in the door here? And you have to begin to analyze what he means by Jesus of Nazareth. This is the historical person as he understands him, as opposed to Jesus Christ, the person we believe in, who he thinks is quite distinct from the person who lived on earth 2,000 years ago. So you have all his personal stuff. Then you have debates going on about his credentials. Does he overplay his credentials? Is he qualified to write a book like this? Well, here are the facts. He did go to university. He is Phi Beta Kappa. He went to Harvard Divinity School for a 2-year degree, a master in theological studies, so he's done some theology. He's been to the University of Iowa, has a master of fine arts. He's been to the Iowa Writers' Workshop and won a distinguished award there. And what just about everybody who has read the book, and I'm going to ask in a second how many of you have read the book, have said is he writes really well. He writes really well. And I have to say to you, having read tons of books, I like people who write really well, even if I disagree with them, because I know what I disagree with them on, as opposed to those who don't write well, and you don't know whether you agree with them or not. So now, there is some confusion along the way, as we will see. I think he does get significantly repetitive at times, and that leads to confusion, but nevertheless, for the most part, he writes well. He has a degree in sociology, but it's sociology of religions, and he is a professor of writing. He's not a professor of New Testament. So he does have the credentials on the one hand. He doesn't have all the credentials on the other hand. And he has not been through the rigor of defending a PhD in New Testament where somebody is going to tear that thing apart. And in fact, I think he would have written a much better book if somebody had torn it apart and he'd put it together again. But hey, we have what we have, and he did what he did. He has done a great deal of work, and he writes well, and that is the context of pretty much everything that I'm going to say, not all of which is positive, but some of it is. In fact, I first read his writing about 4 or 5 years ago in Reading on Islam, his book No God But God, The Origins and Evolution and Future of Islam. It's actually a very good book. If you want to read on Islam, this is a good book to read. And once again, it's highly readable. So he is good, And this is almost certainly not the last we will hear of Reza Aslan. He is an author who has written and will continue, no doubt, to write. Though I would have to say that as far as making a living is concerned, he probably won't have to write another book in his life. I was just told this evening that I think Amazon has to restock. If they have to restock, you know that things are going quickly, that it's hard to get. And actually, when Parkash told me that, I said to him immediately, if anybody has $150, you can have my book. Sorry. So, what are people saying about the book in general? Just a quick lay of the land. A dozen at least reviews of the book. Pretty much all agree that he's a great writer. All agree that there's not much here that's academically new. In other words, if you're a scholar, you're not going to find much that's new here. The key issue here is he's repackaged things in a way that's accessible. Now, that's not a bad thing to do, but has he said something which people go, wow, we've never thought of that before? Well, yes, if you haven't been involved in this area, sure. But if your life is in the academic study of the New Testament, then there is nothing that is new here. There are some things very well stated, I have to say. But there are other things which have been tried out. And in particular, a book by, I've got it in my bag here, S.G.F. Brandon, called The Zealots, Jesus and the Zealots, back in 1967 or 68. He's pretty much rehashed stuff. And indeed, one criticism is he has not given enough credit to work that has gone before, which he has brought to the surface. So nothing much new academically, but some really interesting bits and pieces. Some parts are helpful and good. Some parts, I think, are just not believable. Indeed, perhaps the most daunting critique of his major thesis. So let me say this. He's got his major thesis. I'll come to that in a minute. Then he's got all kinds of other little bits and pieces. Some of those other little bits and pieces are good. Some of them are not so good. And then you've got the major thesis. The fact that the major thesis may not be right doesn't invalidate the rest of the whole book. But his major thesis is, and we'll come back to this and repeat it a number of times, is that Jesus was caught up in the general anger of the people against the Roman invaders. And what you need to think of is the United States in Iraq or in Afghanistan. This is a very close parallel to how people felt. And he had to have been really angry about this and wanted to get violent about this. That's the basic thesis. He had to. And even one of the most liberal scholars, some of you may have read John Dominic Crossan's work on Jesus, says, just not so. I mean, part of what his effect, his impact, was he chose the nonviolent course. So this is not just a conservative reaction against a liberal idea, and all the conservatives, by definition, are going to say, we don't like this, this is rubbish. This is perhaps one of the most liberal scholars of our time, acknowledged by those who like him and don't like him as a brilliant man, saying, you know, I really don't think you've got the evidence there. Where's the army? Where were they raising the troops? None of that's there. It's just not there. So you've got some disagreement, and I'll come up with some other things on that in a minute. But that's what people are saying. The other most significant critique, I think, is one, and I can't remember where this comes, who brings this up, is that Aslan has turned a multifaceted person into a somewhat single-faceted and boring person, so that Jesus must fit into this small mold. But I suppose I think, and others think, wait a minute, he was who he was because nobody could fit him quite into the mold. So when he says, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, my review is, right. Yep. No, it doesn't. So he's bigger than that. And this relatively boring, single-faceted person, once you assume that's who he is, then many of his other parts do fall into place. Why should this happen? Why should that happen? There's no reason. But if, in fact, Jesus is larger than life, for example, he says, Jesus coming before Pilate is a complete fabrication. Pilate would never have had time for Jesus. He's just a Galilean peasant. And the answer is, if in fact the Jesus movement and the person leading it had some charisma about it, danger about it, yes, but charisma about it, maybe he did. And maybe that would be strange and unique, but who's to say? Stranger things have happened. So those are some initial critiques. So what am I going to do in the next 30 minutes or so? Want to go through Aslan's basic assumptions to let you know a little bit about what's going on in the world of biblical studies. And this is actually a really good book to teach biblical studies on. My assessment of those assumptions, and what about the contents of the book? So how many have actually read the book? Good number of, about, 8 or 9 read the book. Okay. So I will go through the contents of the book. I've thought about whether I go through the contents of the book first, or whether I do, I'm going to do my assessment of this thing first. So here we go. What are Dr. Aslan's basic assumptions? Well, the Gospels in the Bible are documents written by believers in order to create faith in Jesus as the divine Son of God. This person is not the same as Jesus of Nazareth, but is Jesus Christ. In other words, as soon as you believe he's God, you're not going to think of him as the normal human being he was, right? So as soon as you think, this is dangerous here, that your wife or husband is divine, you lose touch with reality. Something a little like that is going on here. When you move up to that glorified state, the real world somehow no longer is as ordinary and real as it was. And he sees this happening, and not only he, but a huge number of biblical scholars have this as a basic assumption. The gospel authors, number two, as well as Paul the Apostle, are not interested in the accuracy of historical facts. Historical accuracy is a modern concern. This is a quote. As with everything else in the Gospels, the story of Jesus' arrest, trial, and execution was written for one reason and one reason only, to prove that he was the promised Messiah. Factual accuracy was irrelevant, strong word. What mattered was Christology, who Jesus was, do we worship him or not, not history. This is a black and white statement about facts and history and belief. Black and white, either or. Come back to that in just a minute. So when they tell the story, the gospel authors, they want to reshape it in order to tell it the way they want to tell it and the way they want their audience to hear it. They are marketers. They are in the marketing business. And they have a story to tell, and they want to tell it in exactly the right way, the way they want to tell it, to communicate well. And indeed, I know that this is the case with many books. Somebody wants to write a book with an ordinary title, and what happens when it gets to the publisher? You can't have that title. You're going to change it. Nobody will buy it with that title. Change it for this or that. So marketing is ancient, basically, is what's being said here. Normal, though. So here's another quote. By the end of the first century, when the bulk of the Gospels were being written, Rome, in particular the Roman intellectual elite, had become the primary target of Christian evangelism. Not only did all traces of revolutionary zeal have to be removed from the life of Jesus, the Romans had to be completely absolved of any responsibility for Jesus' death. It was the Jews who killed the Messiah. The Romans were the unwitting pawns of the high priest Caiaphas. This is a hugely important statement in the development of Aslan's thesis. So, here's Jesus. He lives, and we'll come back to this, in around 30 AD. He dies around that time. The early church is born in the next 20, 30 years or so. Then around 60, we're getting close to the end of Paul and Peter's life. In 65, Rome is set on fire. Nero decides that the Christians are to blame, and there's persecution. But going on in Palestine at that time is a Jewish revolt. And in that Jewish revolt, the Jews lose to the Romans, and in AD 70, Jerusalem is destroyed. I mean destroyed. And with it, Judaism, ancient Judaism, ends. It ends. It is such a massive destruction. About 30 years later, there's a revival in Judaism, and the Pharisees are, in fact, the only ones who survive. They are the parents of Rabbinic Judaism, which is modern Judaism, and they pick things up. But there is a period there when Judaism is just about gone. And what he is saying is that the interest in playing to the Jewish crowd for early Christianity dies. And the people who are going to believe are Gentiles and Romans. And in telling the story of Jesus, the story is now told deliberately for those people. And some things about the Romans are downplayed and softened to make it more palatable for the Romans to believe. Okay? And you don't have to worry about the Jews because there aren't any of any significance at this time. You can say bad things about them, but you can't about the Romans. And one of the things you're not going to say is that, I have to get this right, you're going to downplay Jesus as fomenting revolution against Rome. You don't want your Jesus to be that kind of a person because the Romans then won't believe in him. So that whole historical accuracy business of that's who he was, a person zealous to get rid of the Romans, we don't want to tell that story anymore. We want to just say he is the Son of God, and why aren't we all happy and just believe in him? So that's a large part of the central thesis here. So when the Gospels were written and who they were written for caused the writers to ignore some parts of the real Jesus and promote other parts. And the main part is, in fact, nothing to do with Jesus as he lived on earth, but as the divine Jesus who is our Savior. A strict distinction between Jesus of history and the Jesus of faith. I'll give you a little comment on that. I think he makes the Romans to be so stupid and gullible that if I were a Roman, I wouldn't believe his view of the Romans either at that time, because they become wimps in all of this. And if I were a Roman, I'm not sure I would really like that picture of people. So I think he's caught between a rock and a hard place here, but that's one comment amongst many. So the writers are interested not in facts, but in the meaning of facts as they understand them, as they wish them to be understood. The facts, therefore, about Jesus as presented in the Gospels are at best partially true, and the opinions expressed by and about Jesus are biased in some direction or another. So when we read our Bible, so here's our Bible, my Gospel account, the Jesus in here is a picture not of the Jesus who really lived, but of the Jesus that the first Christians came to believe in and wanted to believe in and changed into the image that they wanted him to be changed into. And if we are going to find the real Jesus, we've got to dig beneath the surface to find him. And that's what Reza Aslan and all these other folks have been trying to do. And actually, there's nothing wrong with some of that. There really isn't. And we'll come back to just that in just a minute. As in a court of law, you've got some stories being told. In this case, we've got four Gospels in our Bible. This is their account. This is their testimony. What are the facts behind the testimony? And when I put it that way, yeah, we would all say, sure, you've got to do some of that. Maybe there are things we haven't seen before there. Some of those things we haven't seen may be normal, but most books sell because they are saying that what you haven't seen is really radically different. And I'm now going to show you what that really radically different is. So you look at secular history, you look at your judgment on what's embellished and what's not embellished, you look at the consensus of others, and you try to put a new story together, a credible story. What do we do with this view of the Gospels being biased in one direction or another, embellished, not necessarily with evil intent in one way or another, because people want people to believe in the Jesus they believe in? Well, let me give you a quick rundown of this. So in blue up here, you've got Aslan's, my view of what Aslan is saying. The Gospels in the Bible are documents written by believers in order to create faith in Jesus as the divine Son of God. This is Jesus Christ as opposed to Jesus of Nazareth. And I would answer, yes. Actually, he's right. That's exactly what they were written for. they are, to that extent, biased. And actually, the Gospels say so. In other words, this is not just what scholars say. This is what John says at the end of his Gospel. So when we were going through John's Gospel a couple of years ago, I would repeat these verses. John says at the end of his Gospel, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. I'm writing this so you will believe. And then he goes on to say, I've chosen particular stories because I think they are more powerful than other stories. And then he has this wonderful thing. I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that could be written of all the things that I haven't told you. So the idea that people are finding new things about Jesus, yes, they are out there. The Bible says they're out there. And yes, John put his story together deliberately. He was an editor. He wasn't just a here's this story, that story, or that story. He did it carefully and deliberately so that we would believe. So that much I happen to believe. Our Gospels are carefully written so that we should believe. He goes on to say the Gospel authors, as well as Paul the Apostle, are not interested in the accuracy of historical facts. Historical accuracy is a modern concept. Well, to a certain extent, that's right. The four Gospels are more like four portraits than like four photos. And we certainly have an interest in precision, which they did not have back then. Our scientific age calls for that. But listen, those folks who built those pyramids, they had an interest in precision. I mean, they really did. So the idea that no one had an interest in precision is nuts. And in fact, there are books written about Greek writing of history and their interest in facts, which simply says this is not as black and white as Aslan makes it out to be. So here's my little picture. Let me see if I can get to it here. Monet. So here's a photograph of, where's this of? Giverny. Oh, another photograph of some lilies. And here are the paintings. Which is more truthful? Well, I mean, isn't that a bizarre question? Which is more truthful, these or this? Well, they're truthful in different ways. And in fact, there's a truth in this, in the way that he sees this, which is as beautiful, if not more beautiful, but different. So if I were to pit Monet against the factual kind of, this is the real photograph, it's just a strange contrast. It's not what we do. Life's not like that. They're truthful in different ways. And they serve different purposes. So this either or is simply wrong. In fact, work is being done now on the role of eyewitnesses 2,000 years ago. And they just weren't naive. I mean, they didn't. Our Gospels have got eyewitness accounts in them who were people who were interested in the facts. And as I said, historians 2,000 years ago, yes, they were interested in the meaning of the story, but they just did not willy-nilly twist things to serve their purposes. That's just not how it happened. The Gospel authors, as well as Paul, are interested in the facts? No. Yes, they are, I'd say, but he says no. The way they want to tell it, will they twist everything else to meet the facts? Twist is just too strong. Will they pick and choose? Yes. So Mark's Gospel, read Mark's Gospel of Jesus. Jesus is always in a rush. Jesus is rushing here, immediately there, in the next place. Matthew's Jesus is a teacher. Luke's Jesus is soft in the Pharisees. Jesus goes in and has friends among the Pharisees. John's Jesus gives really long speeches about himself and says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and all kinds of other things. These are different portraits. And there's no reason to be upset with that. God has given us different angles by which to look at Jesus, and this does not equal we don't know who Jesus is. He's larger than life. So do they twist them? Yes, you get the picture here, and I could say more on this. Let me go on and say, the other thing that happens here is saying, as we look at the Gospels, what about all the historical information that we can gather from the world around about us, doesn't that illumine the Gospels in a way that we never saw them before? And I would have to say this is one of the strengths of the book, that Aslan does do a lot of historical background. Not all of it I agree with, but it illumines the story of Jesus in many ways in a positive way. And this is always something we need to do. Let me show you something you may or may not have seen before. Here's a Roman coin. I actually have something like this at home. I forgot to bring. It has on here Caesar, Augustus Caesar. And so this is a coin from the time of Jesus or just before Jesus. We could have got one from Tiberius Caesar. And it calls Caesar on the coin the Son of God. He's the Divus Filius or Filii and Father. So on every Roman coin, and these were in circulation in Jesus' time, you would see beside an image of Caesar the word Father and the word Son of God. Okay? Everybody knows this. Everybody knows this, that these are titles for Caesar. So, when Jesus says, praise our Father, where might he have said this Father lived? In Rome. But he doesn't. He says, our Father in heaven. Friends, this is a political statement. That's a political statement. Our Father is not in Rome. Our Father is in heaven. And the Son of God is not the guy in Rome. It's this Galilean peasant. We do have, I think, a misunderstanding of Jesus, and it's very complicated, Jesus' role with regard to the political life of our world around about us. We want things to be clear-cut. Here's the religious sphere, and here's the political sphere. Life's just not like that, and it wasn't like that then. So I would agree with Aslan that Jesus' ministry had some political ramifications. There's no doubt about it. And historical research shows us that. So there's much I agree with there as well. His book's complicated unless you know your first century history. So if you are going to read it, here's a little chart. I think he has a chart in there as to what happens. But the key issue here is this. Jesus is ministry around AD 30. Paul writes 20 years later. He's the earliest Christian writer. Then the Jews rebel against Rome, and the temple is destroyed, and Jerusalem with it in AD 70. Part of his thesis is that Mark's gospel was written after Rome destroyed Jerusalem. And as I said earlier, was therefore a polemic for Roman Christians to believe in Jesus, and he didn't need to worry about the Jews. That's highly debatable as to whether Mark was written after the destruction of Jerusalem or before. He just assumes it. And so be careful about that. If it was written before, then actually his whole theory just kind of melts away. He's assuming there's one thing there. Scholars debate it. Most would say it probably was written around AD 70, but some would say, and a mix of scholars, actually before AD 70. So, let me go on to the book itself and run quickly through what he does in the book itself. He begins by speaking about himself and his own personal story, and then he gives his premise, which is here again, and hopefully this idea will come through to you, the idea that the leader of a popular messianic movement, this I'm quoting from the book, calling for the imposition of the kingdom of God, implying a revolt against Rome, could have remained uninvolved in the revolutionary fervor that had gripped nearly every Jew in Judea is simply ridiculous. That for me is a statement that would have been excised out of a dissertation straight away. In other words, he doesn't say, I will defend this later, here's A, B, C, and D, Y, or footnotes on it. It's a bland statement which gets you in that frame of mind right from the outset. And this is in This is before we get to page one. To say it is ridiculous. And the book is actually filled with words like that. When it reminds me of the person who said, there was this sermon I saw the text that the minister had. He had notes in the margin. And at one point it said, "Shout here, argument weak." And he shouts when the argument's weak. And so he uses words like ridiculous, complete fabrication, and other words at certain particular points. And if you're reading it, watch for those words and see if, in fact, his statements actually justify those words or whether these are just plain statements spoken strongly at a particular point, just to emphasize the point. But nevertheless, this is his assumption. Jesus had to have been caught up in the revolutionary movement. Well, yes. Well, no. I was in the West Bank in the spring. There are some people there caught up in this sense of being in an occupied country. Everybody's caught up in some way or another, but there are multiple responses. There are multiple responses to that. Everybody's caught up, but there are multiple responses. So he speaks about a lot about the Jewish world of the first century. His history, going through the history of the first century, I think is very valuable. He speaks about the internal divisions within ancient Judaism. These are true, especially focusing on those who controlled the temple. This is all good stuff. The normal people didn't get on well with the rich Jewish people who were in collusion with the Romans and who controlled the temple. He speaks about the reality of Roman rule and how hard that must have been, and it must have been. He speaks about the peasant hope for a new Messiah, and that Messiah would be a literal king. Yes, that's what most people were looking for. Jesus didn't fit it. Even John the Baptist said, "Are you the Messiah? I don't get it. You're not doing what you're supposed to do." So yes, they were looking for a literal king. He speaks about the urbanization of Galilee. And by the way, along the way, he has some one or two just bizarre mistakes. So this is Galilee up here, 70 miles north of Jerusalem. And he speaks about the urbanization of this area, which is just such a strong modern world. There were a few Roman/sophisticated Jewish towns and settlements, Sepphoris and Tiberias, maximum of 30,000 people. And Sepphoris could have been much less. But it doesn't mean that it's not urbanization as we understand it. And it's almost the imposing of modern categories on the ancient world there. He speaks about Capernaum, which is right here, as being a place where Jesus and the disciples would have breathed the sweet salt air. Do you see what's wrong with that? What the dilemma is, and this is part of the critique that people have leveled at him, is in his notes, which are not linked to specific passages but are in general, he speaks about spending plenty time in Jerusalem. He very clearly has not been up to this region, though he speaks as if he knows it well. But there is no salt air around Galilee. The Dead Sea is salt. Sea of Galilee is fresh. It's fresh because the water flows in and then flows out and heads down to the Dead Sea where it can't get out. So it's just a bizarre. I don't even know how an editor missed this one. It just screams at you there. But nevertheless, his general view of the world of that time is powerful. He speaks about Jesus being born in Nazareth, not Bethlehem. And that's an interesting discussion. Scholars go in different directions on that one. Are the stories of Jesus' birth fanciful stories of the birth of a divine being, or are they historical? Well, you can get people arguing in different ways there. Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, is probably the best person to read on this in terms of saying, yes, it was Bethlehem. And he would say, you know, Luke's gospel and Matthew's gospel differ, and many scholars say because they differ, they made this up. Almost every scholar thinks they were written independently, and he would say, why did they both come down on Bethlehem as the place of his birth if it didn't happen? And then a guy called Richard Baucom, who is now, I can't remember, he's back at Oxford or Cambridge, talks about the eyewitnesses involved. He speaks once again more about the background and about the zealots as a movement and people wanting to pick up arms against Rome, the growing anger amongst the poor. Yes, there were plenty of poor people, but he also speaks about the rich fishing on the Sea of Galilee. Not all of them were poor, and Jesus' disciples include a person called Simon the Zealot, and he makes much of that. He makes no mention of the fact that it's also Matthew the tax collector, the collaborator, who must have been intelligent. He speaks about Jesus as illiterate. That's highly debatable. And the disciples as illiterate. That, too, is potentially debatable. If Simon Peter, and they speak about the hired hands, he could well have been a business operator. We don't know, but nevertheless, the fact of the matter is that these are presuppositions which affect what he does. He speaks about the really subpar Roman governors. I'm tempted to say this, but yes, I'll say it. Sent by the Department of State in Rome to other places around the world. But a stream of them were sent who just weren't top-notch, and how the people suffered in the difficulties because of that. And he paints, says the Gospels paint Pilate as a weak person. I don't think they do. He speaks about the Jewish revolt. Some of that is very interesting stuff. And then he speaks about the cover-up job, Christians covering up who Jesus really was after Jerusalem has been destroyed. The question is, was Jesus put to death for sedition by the Romans or blasphemy by the Jews? Some of you may be familiar with what we call the brief statement of faith. In our own Presbyterian church, this section on Jesus says he was unjustly condemned for blasphemy and sedition. And most people would say it's not either or, it's both and. That Jesus was a threat both to the Roman authorities and to the Jewish authorities. Not to every Jew, but the Jewish authorities, whom many Jews counted as bad guys. So it's not against all Jews. It's against those who were deemed to be the bad guys amongst the Jews at that particular time. He goes on to speak about the importance of Jesus on Palm Sunday. This, he says, was the beginning of the revolt. It didn't work. Palm Sunday was huge, but it just failed at that moment. He goes on to speak about John the Baptist being more important than Jesus and the Christians covering that up. More back on Jesus, Jesus speaking about the coming of the kingdom as a this-worldly kingdom and not another-worldly kingdom. The kingdom of God, he says, idea comes from John the Baptist. Actually, it probably comes from the book of Daniel, in which it is both a this-worldly and another-worldly kingdom. So this either-or business, he is black and white on things which are generally both and. Not either-or, but both and. So he can't hold those two things together. He says the main problem with Jesus as a warrior is Jesus' words on loving your enemies. So this is what he says about Jesus. Why do we think that Jesus was a warrior? He says, this one undeniable truth, the same God whom the Bible calls a man of war, is the only God that Jesus knew and the sole God he worshipped. No evidence for this. His commands to love your enemies and turn the other cheek must be read as directed exclusively at his fellow Jews. The commands have nothing to do with how to treat outsiders, especially those savage plunderers of the world who occupied God's land in direct violation of the law of Moses, which Jesus viewed himself as fulfilling. They shall not live in your land. There's no question. They felt pretty much as if Muslims feel about Westerners, non-Muslims in their land today. In any case, neither the commandment to love one's enemies nor the plea to turn the other cheek is equivalent to a call for non-violence or non-resistance. John Dominic Crossan would disagree, and in any case, is not a form of argument. In other words, he basically says, I don't agree with this view, so I'm not going to treat it that seriously. It's very strange. Jesus was not a fool. He understood that every other claimant to the mantle of the Messiah understood God's sovereignty could not be established except through force. Maybe Jesus did understand it differently, which is why his claim to messiahship lasted and theirs didn't. goes on to speak about the Messiah, about Jesus as a king, thinks the trial is a fabrication, and then speaks about the growth of the movement where Jesus becomes more and more divine and less and less historical. I think that's probably enough speaking just now. You kind of, I think, get the drift of how I view this book, and maybe there are some things in here which are helpful. I do have to look at one more thing. There are some strange things which Aslan believes, strange for Aslan to believe. He believes that Jesus actually did believe he was divine. Most scholars taking his route would say Jesus actually didn't believe he was divine. That was added on afterwards. He says the early disciples really believed in a flesh and blood resurrection. But he says that was an act of faith. I find that very strange. If it's a spiritual resurrection, it's an act of faith. If it's a flesh and blood resurrection, then it's a I can touch you, and it's empirical. So he tries to play both sides of the coin, and I don't quite understand why he does this. But hey, I'll take it. He believes in it. He then says Paul really is the main person who, in making Jesus divine, twisted everything around. This is an old story which simply doesn't hold water. He says, why doesn't Paul acknowledge the existence of the Gospels? Well, the answer is, in their written form, they didn't exist until, he's right, around AD 66 or AD 70. But when Paul speaks about Holy Communion, he quotes a section on the night that Jesus was betrayed, which we repeat. He took bread, blessed it, gave thanks, and broke it, and said, this is your body which is given for you. It's almost identical to Luke's gospel. I happen to be convinced that he had pretty much the gospel, if not before him in some kind of written form, he had it in his head. In fact, he had pretty much all of the Old Testament in his head. So this pitting of Jesus against Paul is old stuff, and there's plenty reason to not to do this. So that's the lay of the land, and right at the end, he has this quote, and I'll end with this. Let me see. The Christ of Paul's creation has utterly subsumed the Jesus of history. The story of the revolutionary zealot who walked across Galilee gathering an army of disciples with the goal of establishing the kingdom of God on earth, the magnetic preacher who defied the authority of the temple priesthood in Jerusalem, the radical Jewish nationalist who challenged the Roman occupation and lost, has almost been completely lost to history. That is a shame, because the one thing any comprehensive study of the historical Jesus should hopefully reveal is that Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the man, is every bit as compelling, charismatic, and praiseworthy as Jesus the Christ. He is, in short, someone worth believing in. To which I would say, amen. And say, that last statement is every bit as compelling, yes. Jesus the Christ is every bit as compelling too. And the pitting of the two against each other is a straw man which he throws down. But the church I know holds these two together, or tries to hold them together, and therefore has a Jesus who is not less than larger than life, but larger than life and larger than us, and therefore who, in fact, is compelling and worth believing in.